This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Carol Off.
And I'm C. David Johnson. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. This week, some peace at last. The father of a Marine whose funeral was disrupted by the notorious Westboro Baptist Church wins millions in damages.
Che and a haircut. We get the two bits from the man who has made thousands of dollars from a lock of hair he cropped from revolutionary icon Che Guevara.
How he'd leave in autumn we never will know. The inimitable baritone Robert Goulet dies at 73.
My Quebec includes Canada and all Canadians. The province's cabinet refutes claims of xenophobia in La Belle Province.
And word up, really up, a brief conversation with the world's fastest talking woman. As It Happens, the podcast edition radio with no idle chatter. They go to military funerals and they picket. They are members of a hate group that calls itself a church. Westboro Baptist preaches that the death of any American soldier in Iraq is God's punishment for the fact that the U.S. tolerates homosexuality. Today there was a ruling in the first lawsuit against Westboro Baptist Church to make it to court. A jury ordered the church to pay $10.9 million for causing emotional distress to the family of Matthew Snyder after picketing his funeral. Matthew's father, Albert Snyder, and his lawyer, Sean Summers, spoke to guest host Helen Mann from York, Pennsylvania.
Mr. Snyder, your reaction today, how are you feeling about this decision?
I feel really good about the decision. I think the jury made the right decision. Today's been such a whirlwind of activity, I haven't had much time to even think today. But I'm very happy with the verdict. I think it opens the door for other lawsuits now to come forward for people that they've done this to in the past, and maybe even a class action suit.
Mr. Summers, your opinion on that, is it setting a precedent that will open the door for these other suits?
Certainly it is, and it's not just a legal precedent, it's a psychological precedent, so these other families know that there is a recourse for what the Westboro Baptist Church does to people. In fact, it gives people some hope that you can fight back.
Mr. Snyder, tell us what the Westboro Baptist Church did to you. Tell us about the circumstances of your son's funeral and the impact their presence had on you.
Well, basically what they did was, I think it was 2 days before the funeral, they sent out a notice that they were coming up to protest and saying that they would be picketing the funeral of Matthew Snyder at St. John's Catholic Dog Kennel. And on the day of the funeral, they showed up with their signs such as "Thank God for Dead Soldiers," "Thank God for IEDs," "Semper Fi Fag," "God Hates Fags," "He's in Hell." Just a lot. The day of the funeral, I tried to concentrate mostly on my son, so I really didn't look at the signs or see what the signs said. I did see the signs, but I couldn't read them at that point. About an hour after the funeral, when everyone was back at my parents' house, of course the news came on and I got to hear the Phelps and I got to hear and see their signs. It just more or less was just shocked. I stood there with my mouth open. I couldn't believe that anybody could do that to another human being, what they did to my son. My son was a good man and he didn't deserve what he got.
At what point did you decide it was time to litigate?
Well, I think it was a couple months after I had buried Matt. I was watching the news one night, and I saw them do this to another soldier. And I laid in bed that night, and by the next morning I said, no, I'm going to do something. They're not going to keep doing this to the military. You know, these kids, they don't choose to go over there. They're told to go over there. And, you know, the least we can do is when they come back in a box, the least we can do is give them a burial with dignity and respect.
Mr. Summers, tell me about the case itself and the evidence that was presented.
Well, we presented Al as a witness to say what happened. We presented the police officers. What they do when they send out this news release is they also send out a request to the police and request for police protection. So in response, the police know that there might be violence there, so they dispatched five police cars, five different sheriffs. They had ambulances on standby, fire trucks on standby, a SWAT team on standby, and a command and control unit in the form of a Winnebago. So what they do is they turn this funeral into a three-ring circus. We had the priest testify that he couldn't console the family because he was dealing with logistics, trying to keep these lunatics away from the family as much as possible. And then we also had Mr. Snyder's doctors testify to talk about the trauma that Mr. Snyder was exposed to based upon their actions. Now, obviously, the death of his son also caused a lot of trauma, but the protesters exacerbated that trauma.
I understand, Mr. Summers, that some other states have also tried to outlaw picketing at these funerals. Why have they not been successful where you have been?
Maryland has as well. The difference here is those are criminal statutes, sort of like a trespassing statute. What we did is we brought a civil suit for damages, and we are, in fact, hoping that other families do come forward, because the reality is that I believe, in my estimate, this lawsuit costs them $100,000. If they're tied up in two or three lawsuits throughout the country and it's costing them $100,000 at a shot, that alone will probably bankrupt them, and then they won't be allowed to run around the country and terrorize people. You know, Matt Snyder went off to war to fight terrorists, and Al Snyder's been fighting terrorists at home because of the protesters. They're essentially terrorists.
Mr. Snyder, the members of this church, the Reverend Phelps and his family, say that their First Amendment rights allow them to protest in this way. I mean, in our country, we have charter protections for speech. What do you say to their argument that you're limiting their freedom of expression?
Well, I'm not. The freedom of speech comes with a certain amount of responsibility, and there is some speech that is not protected by the First Amendment, which the judge instructed the jury on. And certainly I had constitutional rights that day too, and they violated my constitutional rights, and their freedom of speech does not override my constitutional rights that day also.
Did you have any reason to anticipate that you would have such an overwhelming victory, at least in terms of the damages here? I mean, punitive damages are extremely high here.
I never dreamed it, to be honest with you, Helen. I, you know, it wasn't about the money. It was about just trying to stop them and set a precedence so that other families could do the same thing that I was doing.
Mr. Summers, what was the judge's reasoning for this very large award?
Right. Actually, it was a jury. So the jury was free to assess whatever damages that they thought were appropriate. The bottom line here is Mr. Snyder had one and only opportunity to bury his son, and they tarnished that forever. So every time Mr. Snyder thinks about burying his son, he's also going to think about what they did to him. So the ultimate question for the jury is, what is that worth? It's a difficult figure to come to, but this jury decided it was worth $2.9 million for him to think about that the rest of his life. And then, obviously, they were disgusted with their actions, so that's why they assessed the $8 million in punitive damages.
Mr. Snyder, do you think this is going to stop Westboro from taking these actions in the future?
Well, I think it'll limit their travel because they won't have the money for the plane fares and the hotels. But, you know, they certainly will keep protesting, and Helen, I don't have a problem with them protesting. If they want to protest, let them protest all they want. Let them go to the White House and protest. Let them go to their congressman's office and protest. Stand in a park and protest. But don't do it at somebody's funeral.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. I do appreciate it, and you too, Mr. Summers. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks, you.
Thanks, Helen.
All right, good to talk with you. Goodbye.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Albert Snyder was awarded $10.9 million in damages from a Maryland court. And Sean Summers is his lawyer. They were speaking to guest host Helen Mann. Both were in York, Pennsylvania. Images of a hirsute Che Guevara are ubiquitous. The guerrilla leader's face, framed by an unruly mane tucked up underneath a beret, can be seen on T-shirts and posters in head shops and sidewalk stands around the world. In 1967, Che Guevara was executed in Bolivia by a group of CIA-backed soldiers. His hair, as well as other artifacts, were gathered moments before his burial by one Gustavo Viodo. Recently, a lock of that famous hair was sold at auction for the hair-raising price of $119,000. We reached Mr. Viodo in Culver, Alaska.
Mr. Viodo, what possessed you to take a sample of Che Guevara's hair before you buried him?
Well, Carol, you know the—I don't know whether you know this or not—but the symbol of the Cuban Revolution, when Castro and Che Guevara came down from the mountains, was the long beard and the long hair, and that was a symbol of the, unfortunately, of the revolution that Cuba is going through still. And to me, when I did that, was basically a psychological, personal gesture of saying, "Hey, here I'm eradicating the symbol of the Cuban Revolution."
You hated Che Guevara.
Hated is a very strong word. When you have an opponent, you deal with it without any emotion, and that's what I did or tried to do. But, you know, when somebody forces your father, like Castro and he did, to commit suicide in order to take over my father's businesses, which he was the owner of the General Motors franchise for Cuba, so, you know, you don't feel very happy about it. On the contrary, when he was put down, I actually felt sorry for his family and for himself, and, of course, for the 55 widows that were left behind because of his incursion into Bolivian territory.
Did you take any other trophies besides the lock of his hair?
The album contained the hair. It contained personal ID cards given to me by the president of Bolivia and the commanding general of the armed forces there, General Ovando. The map, there's the fingerprints, original fingerprints.
Was the map instrumental for you in tracking where Che Guevara and the guerrillas were?
That's correct. You know, the map for military operation is essential. It gives you a view of the terrain and the cover, concealment, and other critical information for you to be able to operate successfully.
Were you present when Che Guevara was assassinated?
No, I was not.
Did you play a role in his assassination?
None whatsoever. The order came from the president of Bolivia and with the sanctions of the military command, and it was done only through their express orders, and we had nothing to do with that.
So who exactly was the squad that killed Guevara then?
There were soldiers from the 2nd Ranger Battalion that was operating in the area. And that's a good battalion that I went in with. And it was basically came down through the command system, through the radio frequency of the Army, and it was picked up by a second lieutenant in the operational area, and he carried out the orders of the president of Bolivia.
At what point did you arrive on the scene then?
I arrived later. I was close by, but I was in the what is called the forward command post, and I met him coming down on the helicopter, and when he arrived in Valle Grande.
How many other people were part of the group that was killed that day besides Che Guevara?
There were only but two others with him. Their name was Cuba, like Cuba, and the other one was El Chino Chang. Both, I believe, if my memory serves me right, they were Peruvian and Chilean. Mm.
Now, it's believed that, or it's actually documented, that the CIA was involved with the Bolivian soldiers in the killing of Che Guevara. Were you part of that?
There was only one other person with me. He was my radio operator. There were no other foreigners. And we did not work for the agency. Let me make that clearly. I was never an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency. I did work with them, but not for them.
But the New York Times says that that your involvement with the CIA has been corroborated by declassified American government documents. Are you saying you were not an operative?
I can say to you without any hesitation that I was in Bolivia under contract with the Bolivian government, and I was not in the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. nor was I ever a member of the Central Intelligence Agency.
You sold this collection of memorabilia for $119,000, yes?
That's correct.
There was only one bidder. Why do you think it attracted so little attention?
I think basically there was so much news about it that perhaps what would have been a normal investor felt that, for example, they were claiming that Chavez, the president of Venezuela, was going to purchase it. And my personal opinion is that it was more negative than positive, the fact that it was so publicized. People became afraid that they would not be able to compete, or I don't know, this is just a guess on my part.
You've had these souvenirs, if I can call them that, for 30 years. Why have you decided to sell them now?
Very simple. I'm Carol, I'm 72 years old. To my family, my kids, who are not part of that history. And I felt that by doing that, I would place the documentation and everything else in the book and the album in hands of somebody who will take care of it, one because of the investment that they will have in the lot, and the other one because perhaps they would appreciate what part of history was that, not for me, but for the hemisphere and my country of birth, Cuba.
Are you sorry to let it go?
No, you know, I had two enemies there. One was Castro, who's dying in Cuba with cancer. And the other one was Che, who were the both responsible for my father committing suicide in Havana on February 16, 1959. And I'm an American citizen, proud to be one. And to me, Cuba right now is history, and I have reached foreclosure on that subject with the selling of this memorabilia.
Mr. Villoldo, I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Carol, it's an honor to be with you all, and you know, all the best to you and your program.
Thank you.
Good day.
Gustavo Villoldo was in Culver, Alaska. Robert Goulet was a knight in shining armor with the looks and a voice that made maidens swoon. The year was 1960, and in the role that would cement his career, Mr. Goulet appeared as Sir Lancelot, opposite Julie Andrews as Guinevere, in the Broadway production of Camelot. Mr. Goulet died this week in Los Angeles while awaiting a lung transplant. He was 73. He was born November 26, 1933, in Lawrence, Massachusetts, to Canadian parents. At just 5 years old, he began honing his vocal skills by singing at family gatherings and later in church. When he was 13, his father Joseph died, prompting his mother Jeanette to move the family to Edmonton. Robert continued developing his voice by taking singing lessons. And at 16, he performed professionally for the first time with the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra. Around the same time, he began work as a disc jockey at CKUA Radio. One of the friends he made at the station all those years ago was Tommy Banks. Mr. Banks is now a senator. We reached him in Ottawa.
Senator Banks, how are you feeling today, having heard about what happened to your friend?
A little sad. It's always, Carol, you know, sad to learn it, which we did last night. Particularly when that friend is not, you know, hasn't been noticeably ill at all ever in his life that I remember. He was sort of a picture of health.
But this is quite a serious condition that he died from. Did you not know that he was this ill?
No. Well, nobody did. He was performing in the northeastern United States in September and flew home and noticed that he was ill, and he was unaware before that of any problem. And it turned out, as you say, to be very serious. It was pulmonary thrombosis, and that's very serious.
And it's a rapidly progressive condition, isn't it? Well,
it must have gone very quickly. Yeah.
How did you first meet Robert Goulet?
Well, we were both precocious kids, I guess. We were both working at CKUA Radio in Edmonton in 1950. He was 16 and I was 14, and that's when we became friends, and then we worked together in musical theater a bit. That's where he got his start in musical theater.
What were you doing at CKUA?
He was pretty well full-time, I mean, theoretically part-time, because he was still in high school at St. Joseph's High School in Edmonton, but he was a staff announcer at CKUA and performed, sang, of course, on CKUA as well. And I was hosting a program and doing some performing as well. In those days, there was rather a lot of live music on radio, you know. Those of us who have gray hair remember that there was a lot of live music on radio then.
But you were just kids.
Yeah. He was 16. I was 14 at the time.
Uh-huh. And so was that, did you know that he was destined for this kind of a career?
Yeah, there was no doubt. It was very clear to everybody that he was going to succeed in some aspect. And we assumed that it would be musical theater because he loved musical theater from day one. He loved the theater. He was an arresting presence on stage, particularly later. You know, the first couple of years he was, a lot of critics said that he had this, you know, gorgeous voice, but that he was a little wooden on stage. But he overcame that very quickly and became a riveting stage performer.
And what did he tell you? I mean, when you were young together, that what were his aspirations?
Well, the sky. You know, he knew. I don't know whether he knew, but he certainly was determined to give it a shot. So the logical thing for him to do after he had established himself pretty well as a fixture in Edmonton was to go to the next Big Apple, which was, of course, at the time Toronto. Mm. And he succeeded there and was almost a fixture on CBC television. Well, he was every Sunday night on General Electric Showtime with Shirley Harmer. We saw Robert Goulet. And then he auditioned for Camelot, and everybody knows what happened after that.
And then the Camelot story is interesting because he was willing to do it for nothing. He wanted the job so bad, and they were offering him $750 a week, and he didn't care. He just wanted to be there.
Well, if you get a chance to perform in a show of which Richard Burton is going to be one of the stars, you leap at it. But, you know, when you're not established, I think that any aspiring stage performer would say, I'll do it for nothing. I don't care about the money. But, of course, fortunately, there are stagecraft unions that say, well, you can't do it for nothing.
Good thing.
Yeah.
How did you keep in touch with him over the years?
Variously. We would occasionally see each other, be in the same place at the same time doing television in one or another. We did quite a bit of television with him in Vancouver at one point. And occasionally in Edmonton, he would come there to perform, and occasionally I would be in Los Angeles or Las Vegas when he was performing. It was very occasional. The last time I talked to him was about 6 months ago, and the last time I actually saw him was about 2 years ago.
But people think of him as being Canadian. I mean, he spent those years in Canada. His career began. We certainly remember him on TV,
Yeah. The
man with the bedroom eyes, as they used to call him. And yet he never became a Canadian citizen.
No, he was one of those. The law with respect to immigration and citizenship changed, and I'm not familiar with its niceties, but in around the 1980s someplace, there was a period during which people who had spent a lot of time in Canada, as he did, consecutive years, notwithstanding that they hadn't been born here, could pretty easily get Canadian citizenship, but he didn't do that. I guess it's one of the things that didn't occur to him. And he always thought of himself as having a, you know, a large part of him is being Canadian, but he didn't. And about 3 years ago, we were talking about that fact, and he said that he would like to gain Canadian citizenship so that he would be, you know, a dual citizen. And he made some efforts in that respect, which unfortunately weren't completed.
How important was the idea of just being part from Canada or having spent those years in Canada? Did it matter to him?
Oh, it mattered to him a lot. He always alluded to it, both in conversations and quite frequently on the stage, because his start, his development, his schooling, his growing up, the things that he learned, and the person that he eventually became were largely formed by the time that he spent here.
And what do you think was formed? What do you think informed him from living here?
Well, he was a good guy. I mean, most Canadians are, you know.
Well, that says it.
Yeah, it does. And that is a business in which people sometimes lose touch with a certain kind of reality in terms of who they really are and what's really important. And he didn't ever really lose touch with that.
But his career was in the United States.
Almost, well, yeah, from the time of Camelot on, it pretty well was. I mean, he was a big performer and very successful in the days when the big names played in Vegas. And in fact, he moved to Las Vegas and lived there.
How will you remember him?
very happily, as I said, as a good guy, with his smile, which was of course one of his trademarks on stage, was genuine, because he was always like that. That wasn't any part of an act. He was a very happy guy, and I will remember him as one of the. There's never been a better musical theater voice than Robert Goulet's.
So you're not going to remember him so much as a friend, you just remember that beautiful voice.
Well, I will happily remember him as a friend as well, but when Robert Goulet pops into your mind, you think of him singing If Ever I Would Leave You, you know, or anything else that he chose to sing for musical theater.
Thanks for speaking with us, Senator Banks.
My pleasure, Carol. Thank you very much.
That was Senator Tommy Banks speaking about his old friend, singer Robert Goulet. Mr. Goulet died on October 30th at the age of 73. Well, that conversation with Senator Banks got talk back, waxing lyrical about their own memories of Mr. Goulet.
Hi, my name is Cher Snyder, and I'm calling from St. Thomas, Ontario. I know most of us would think that Robert Goulet was from a generation ahead of the current children, but anybody who has a child that's about age 10 or just a little older would know Robert Goulet's voice from Saturday morning. He was the singing voice of a character in a Walt Disney family series called Recess. The first time I heard it on a Saturday morning, I was doing some house cleaning. My daughter of 6 was watching TV, and all of a sudden I hear Robert Goulet's voice. I'm of a generation that heard Robert Goulet through Brigadoon productions on CBC, and it was quite amusing to see my 6-year-old daughter listening intently to Robert Goulet.
Hi, this is Michelle Bone from Okotoks, Alberta. I was just listening to your piece on Robert Goulet. Always remembered him for something you guys didn't mention, which was, I do believe he was the star of Blue Light, which was a not about the beer. It was a World War II thriller half-hour series on CBC way back when, probably in the late 60s, early 70s, because I was quite young. And he played an Allied spy working in Germany. Nobody ever mentioned it. Nobody talks about it anymore. But just wondering if my memory was correct.
My name is Sally White, calling from Vancouver, British Columbia. I knew Bob personally because I lived in Edmonton when he was there, and we were in the same musical production at the Edmonton Recreational Center, and it was for young teenagers. And I remember seeing him on stage in one of the rehearsals because I was in the show as well. And I said, who is that fellow? I said, he's going to go very far because of his gorgeous voice. And, of course, he's very, very handsome. And even though I hadn't kept in touch with Bob, as I knew him, Bob Goulet, I was so sad and I just burst into tears.
Yes, Michelle, you were right. Robert Goulet was in the TV show Blue Light back in 1966. The Premier of Quebec wants you to know that his province is not a place of prejudice. This week, an open letter from Jean Charest was printed in Quebec newspapers. It addresses the ongoing debate about, quote-unquote, reasonable accommodation of minorities. In it, he accused the media and his political opponents of stirring up intolerance and besmirching Quebec's reputation. Benoit Peltier is Mr. Charest's minister responsible for democratic reform and intergovernmental affairs. We reach Mr. Peltier in Quebec City.
Mr. Peltier, your leader, Premier Charest, wrote in his letter today that he's worried that Quebec is getting a reputation in the rest of Canada, but also the United States and France for being racist. What's his concern?
Well, it's about all the debate that is going on in Quebec and the interpretation of that debate that is made both by the ADQ and the PQ, the Liberal government in Quebec. We are in favor of an open society. We want Quebec to be a very inclusive society. And this is the message that we are sending to the world.
Specifically, which are the things of the ADQ and of the PQ that has led you to believe that they are not in the same page as you?
The ADQ has put into question the importance of immigration in Quebec. They have, in fact, asked if it was necessary to welcome so many immigrants in Quebec. I think that we should be more open to immigrants and welcome more immigrants in the future, because we do rely demographically on immigrants in order to strengthen Quebec as a society.
And the Parti Québécois?
And for the Parti Québécois, you probably know that Mrs. Marois has proposed a bill in which, in fact, she proposes that we give some democratic rights to some individual on the basis of their language, so that some individuals who will not learn French will not have some of these democratic rights. Is it the Quebec that we want for 2007? My answer is no.
But what role have the Liberals played in creating this environment? I mean, your party created the Bouchard-Taylor Commission to hear views from the public on reasonable accommodation of minorities, as it's called. But at those commission hearings, especially as they get closer to Montreal, there have been extraordinary numbers of intolerant opinions voiced there. Are you really trying to quell the flames, keep things calm, or are you actually fanning the flames as much as the other parties?
No, two things. First of all, there is a debate in the Quebec society that existed even before we installed the Bouchard-Taylor Commission. So we did not create that debate. It is a debate that is viable, that is necessary in our society, like it is in many other societies in the world. But the role of the government and the role of politicians is to well manage such a debate, not to fuel the debate with bad concepts or negative concepts.
But we've heard that some of the comments made at the Bouchard-Taylor Commission, people who have stood to say that they believe that that Muslims are taking over Quebec, that the price of food is so high because of kosher food, that walnuts specifically are so costly because of the Jews. How can you say this is a viable debate when such remarks are being made?
Well, we do not agree on the fact that these comments are expressed. But do you know any society where there is no one who has a racist point of view? I don't know any. The most important is that the debate is overall civilized. There is a freedom of opinion in our society, but we do not agree on these opinions. But overall, that debate is necessary.
The question is it how does a government manage that, as you just mentioned? What is allowed by the government? And some are suggesting that your commission is giving these political views legitimacy as they speak before the commission.
Well, one way to manage that for a government like ours is to, first of all, insist on the fact that Quebecers should establish, elaborate, their common values. But at the same time, the government has a special role. It is to remind everyone that within these common values, there must be tolerance.
Then why has your government introduced legislation that would take away the right to vote with a veil? Given the fact that there's only about, the Montreal Gazette has done some research to find there's only about 24 Muslim women in Quebec who actually wear face coverings, and none has ever asked to exercise her right to vote with her face covered. Why would you go ahead with legislation that seems so provocative?
Well, what we will go ahead is a proposal that will not only apply to those who wear a veil, but to anyone who has the face covered by everything. We feel that democratically speaking, anyone should be able to identify herself or himself clearly. And it's not something that is against the Muslims. It does apply to everyone.
Why also did your government decide to amend the Quebec Charter of Rights to give what they're saying gender equality precedence over freedom of a religion? Why would you create a hierarchy of rights in that way?
Well, two things. First of all, because we really believe in equality of genders in Quebec, and we think that it is a principle that, in fact, is very consensual. But second, let me note that there is Section 28 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which provides for the same situation. So, you see, there is nothing special in Quebec. Don't try to find anything that is special to Quebec society. It's all related to modern debates in a modern world.
Monsieur Peltier, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Benoit Peltier is Quebec Premier Jean Charest's minister responsible for democratic reform and intergovernmental affairs. He was in Quebec City. She can talk your ear off, and anyone else's ear for that matter. Fran Kapo holds the Guinness World Record for the fastest talking woman. Next month, she's coming to Toronto to judge other motor mouths in a Canadian fast talker contest. We got a word in with her at her home in New York.
So just exactly how fast can you talk, Ms. Kapo?
Well, I was clocked at the first time I was clocked at 585 words a minute, and then I was clocked at 603.32 words a minute. Well, actually, 603.32 words in 54.2 seconds, which comes out to 11 words a second.
Do you always talk this quickly?
No, not always, because, I mean, you know, if I'm telling my... Well, in certain instances, I'm also a certified hypnotherapist, so could you imagine me trying to relax the person? Or relax,
no.
Relax. So there are times that I do have to slow down.
And after you've had a coffee, are you even faster than this?
Now, here's the thing. I don't drink coffee. It's the weirdest thing. If I actually drink coffee, it slows me down. And if I drink cranberry juice, it gets me drunk. So my body works very differently.
Now, just to experiment. Give me an example of the slowest you ever talk.
The slowest I ever talked would be like this, but it is very painful.
Why is it painful?
Because my brain is going, what is the matter with you? You have so many things you want to do and you want to say, and then I don't feel my life force when I'm talking slow.
Mm. So now, why did you get into actually competing as a fast talker?
No, well, actually, it wasn't a competition. What happened was, I was a stand-up comic. I mean, I'm still a stand-up comic. And I was working at a radio station and WBLS-FM in New York City. And I was doing the weather and traffic. And so kidding around, one day I said to the disc jockey, I said, you know what? I could do a really cool Mae West impression, but I called the character Janice, Mae West's long-lost sister. He turns around, hands me the weather and traffic copy. The red tally light comes on. And so I start doing, oh, today the weather and traffic is. And in the 30 seconds I happened to do it, a lady from the Daily News was listening. She calls the station. She says, listen, I'm doing a story on weather and traffic people. How long have you been doing it? And, you know, I wasn't going to tell her 30 seconds. So it's like, oh, I've been doing it a while. And she says, oh, you don't want to write a story on you, blah, blah, blah. What are you planning on doing next? Well, the thing is, I didn't have a next, but I had the lady on from the newspaper. I wanted to tell her something. So out of the top of my head, I said, oh, I'm thinking of breaking a world record. And she's like, for what? But I didn't have a for what. So I said, I couldn't tell her right then. She said, well, the article had to go in by 6 o'clock. If I decided to tell her, to give her a call. Run out, buy a Guinness book, start looking through it. And then I see that, you know, record for fast talking. I call her back. I said, oh, I'm thinking of breaking the record for fast talking. She's like, what's the record at? At that point in time, the record was 552 words a minute. Had no clue in my head how fast or slow or whatever that was. So I said to her, record's 552. She goes, what are you at? I went, 550. And I said, those last two words are a killer. So she prints it in the paper. The very next day, the Larry King Live people call me up and ask me to go on the show and break the record. And to be honest with you, I didn't know who Larry King was. I just heard cable. So in my head at that time, cable, I was like, is this some kind of porn? They're like, oh, honey, no, this is a national show. I said, what if I don't break the record? She goes, Larry doesn't care whether you break it. And I just care that you come on the show and try it. So I called up Guinness. They said I had to do something for me, the Shakespeare or the Bible. I had a prayer that my mother had taught me. I had 5 hours in the limo for the car to come pick me up. And in those 5 hours, I practiced the 91st Psalm, and when I got to the studio, at that time, I broke the record doing 585 words a minute, and then I rebroke it at the Guinness Museum in Vegas doing the 603.32 words in 54.2 seconds.
What was the 0.32
words? You know, I, to this day, I still go, now how did the timer get that? But the thing is, it's a very technical record. They have a speech, first they have an Olympic timer time you to the hundredth of a second. Then they have a machine called the lexicon compressor, which takes the word, slows it down, but doesn't distort it like a tape recorder does. Then they take the tape and they send it to a speech analyst who analyzes every single syllable against the text that you said. So it's not like you could just be going, you know, hey, my wife, you actually have to be saying words.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, I wanted to make sure that I said something that I would know, you know.
Who knew there was so much science in being a fast talker?
Let me tell you, I didn't even know. I didn't even know, to be honest with you, at one point the Discovery Channel wanted to do a whole thing on my brain. I didn't even know, to be honest with you, what section of the brain controlled anything. And there's the Broca section of your brain, which actually controls speech. And I found out that most people speak by when they look at something, they'll, like, those who make things happen, they'll read it word by word. But for some reason, my brain does a thing called chunking. So it'll just see it as a sentence, like those who make things happen. It'll just see it like that.
Do you breathe?
Well, I have to. I have to take a deep breath at the beginning, otherwise I'd run out. Can you imagine? You know, it's not like an asthmatic at the end, so I do want to make sure I'm breathing at the beginning and hopefully get it all at the same thing. But, I mean, I've kind of learned breath control being, you know, because I'm a stand-up comic and as a performer and things like that, I just kind of know where to take my breaths naturally.
All right, you know, we have to have an example of your fast talking. So what do you want to give us?
Well, I could do it. I'll give you two. What I'll do is I'll first do the 91st Psalm because that's the one that I did to, like, break the record. But then I'm going to do what I call Evelyn Wood reading her kids a bedtime story.
You're going to recite the 91st Psalm now.
I'll do that. I'll
all
do
right.
that for you. Ready?
Go.
He did all take a place at the Most High, shall abide in the shadow of the mighty sea, my Lord's in refuge for fortune of the God in whom we trust.
There you go.
It's lightning litany. You go to church, that would happen. I mean, luckily, I don't do my stand-up that way. Otherwise, people will come to the show and go, that's it? It's over? What are you talking about? You know?
All right, so give me the your bedtime story.
You want the bedtime story?
Absolutely.
I call it Evelyn Wood reading her kids a bedtime story. Okay, kids, Mommy's going to read you The Three Little Pigs. What's the time the three little pigs? One little pig likes to sing, the second little pig likes to dance, the third little pig likes to sit and think. Then a big wolf comes, little pig, let me in. Never be chee-chee, never be chee-chee, never be chee-chee, but to the next pig's house. Little pig, let me in. Never be chee-chee, and soft, you'll have to get somebody to climb. Then there's too many pigs out of bite of only one wolf, and they wolf soup. Tomorrow, war and peace.
And you breathed as well.
And I mean, you got to breathe in there. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to huff and puff. Can you imagine?
The huffing and puffing, yeah.
I get into a fight with my ex-husband. He goes, was I in a fight? I go, listen, none of were you in it. It's over. You lost.
Anyway, it's great to talk fast with you, Ms. Capo.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
It would have been an hour interview.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Fran Capo is the world's fastest talking woman. We reached her at her home in New York. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, following the world at 6.
You can also listen to the whole show on the web. Just go to cbc.ca/AIH and link to our online archive. Thanks for listening. I'm Carol Off.
And I'm C. David Johnson. Have a great week.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.